So now let me apologize. This talk is going to be slightly different than the other ones in this workshop, because I mean it's going to be a little slightly more technical talk than the ones you used to, and also it's talk about work that's not yet published. So I try to make it possible. That makes it harder to follow. So I try to make it understandable. So what I want to basically, I'm going to talk about three things that look slightly unrelated. So I'm going to start talking about anomalies, in more precisely the super dual conformal symmetry in n equals 4. And then I want to present a conjecture. So this talk is really about a conjecture. And well, do we need yet another conjecture in that field? So I'm going to try to convince you that the conjecture is useful and that it allows you to do non-trivial two-loop computations and which need to pass all consistency checks. So two-loop test. So the motivation is that so far what we've been doing in n equals 4 has not ex we know n equals 4 is integrable. And at weak coupling, we've not used that very much. Very little, actually. We've used the bosonic dual conformal invariants. It was very helpful to do loop computations, reduce the size of integral basis, understand what the answer looked like. That was really useful. But this is the only non-obvious symmetry that we've used so far, really, at weak coupling. So how do you use the rest of this yang-yang? How do you use the rest of this symmetry? So the other ones look harder to use because, as people have discussed, Beisel have discussed a couple of days ago, and is well known, super DCI look anomalous. So you just look at the answer. We know a lot of answer. Anomalous. You hit with this generator on the answer, and you don't get zero. You get some right-hand side. So the super dual conformal symmetry looks something like symmetry that looks like d theta ddx, where there's all the dual space variable. I'm going to explain the notation soon. Act on that on some answer, and you get some right-hand side that's non-zero. And then, well, so to use the symmetry, it just seems like you have to understand what right-hand sides look like. We understand very well at one loop, but basically no data at two loops. So I'm going to make a conjecture that allows us to make use of this symmetry. So let me describe where the idea comes from. We've been knowing for, well, it was always clear in this story that the reason there's this anomaly is that there are collinear singularities, collinear regions. Not necessarily collinear divergences. I emphasize that. Something like the ratio function, which is completely finite, has this anomaly. But it's because it has collinear singularities. So integrable singularities, but still singularities. So it's understood that the anomalies have to do with these collinear singularities. And there's also one. Maybe I don't need to discuss that one, that viewpoint, but it's also a sharp property of the integrand, as the if you look at the integrand that is constructed from the recursion relation, One thing which got us puzzled as when we had this recursion relation is that it made all symmetries of the theory manifest. If you look at the integrum, it makes all symmetries manifest in the sense that it transforms the total derivative under all these symmetries. So we're very puzzled because we had an integrum which made even symmetries which are supposed to be anomalous were manifest. So we're puzzled for a few seconds. And the resolution, of course, is that you do an integral of some integrand. You hit it with, and now let's say I'm talking about the ratio function. So this is a completely finite integral. I do it in four dimensions. All is fine. Act on the answer with this object. So if I commute this past the integration sign, I get theta dd. So now this is acting on the external data. Dxi on the integrand. And that turns into, the statement is that turns into some total derivative with respect to the loop integration part of something which is precisely computable from the recursion relation. So you do that, and then if you say that this integrates to so you can do that, you get this. Or you can act with the operator on the answer. Then you find that it's non-zero. So you have those two equations, which are true. And the resolution, of course, is that when you take this derivative, you have to be careful to do it on R4 minus a region with the singularities. And then if you're careful, you're supposed to get the boundary term. So in this picture, again, you see that where are the singularities here? They're from the collinear regions. So again, in this picture, you see that the anomaly localizes to collinear singularities. So now, this is all nice, but it was not quantitatively useful yet, because you have to calculate this, and this is subtle. We could not turn it into a machine. This is where duality becomes interesting. So this is the story on the scattering amplitude side. So now let's go to the t-dual picture. In which we're looking at the Wilson loop. For those of you who've never read about this duality, the duality I'm talking about is one between the S matrix of certain massless particle, the T dual to the expectation value of a certain null polygonal Wilson loop in the same theory. And the kinematic data, I remind you that the momentum all the external momenta add up to zero in this picture. And in this picture, they become the length of edges, and they add up to zero. So this is roughly the dictionary. If someone handed you that and didn't do any computation to confirm this, you would think it's crazy, but it works. So let's use this dual picture to try to see what is happening on this side. So what is happening on this side? What is integrand there? It has a name. Its name is not going to matter. It's called Lagrangian insertion, but it doesn't matter what it is. You're integrating over something which looks like a point in that picture. This is the integrand. You're integrating over this. So x in this integral is this x. And you're doing something called dx. And what's the boundary of this integral? It is some tube along the Wilson loop, which is where your singularities are. So you're supposed to do integral over the whole space-time except for a small tube here. And the boundary integral is an integral over something that looks like R cross S2, which is a small tube. So D of the integration region is some topology, some S1 cross S2. So roughly what happens is that as you go near this boundary, you get some flux.
Yeah.
You can make this picture precise, but I won't. What I want to say is that what this picture makes clear is that the anomaly corresponds to some local excitation in the theory that is propagating along the edge. So from this picture, what you learn is, so could make this map precise, but I won't need that. So I would just need the insight that the anomaly is equal to some local operator inserted on the loop. So once you say those words, you could try to just be honest and calculate what this operator is from this duality and all that. But what can it be? We know the quantum number of these operators. What can this operator be? It's simple. It's just this symmetry generator, called it Q bar. Well, this background, you have this Wilson loop. This is a background which breaks supersymmetry. This operator is just inserting a Goldstone fermion on this edge. So just from this picture, you know that this operator is the Goldstone fermion here. So you have a Goldstone fermion going around the loop, and that is what is telling you the anomaly. So an equation, so you start with the Bosonic-Wilson loop, which has some a mu, dx mu, and Q bar is sort of turning this into some integral of dx mu of some fermion. So that's the picture. But now, once you start saying these words, you see, why don't you define a bigger object? Why don't you introduce a bigger object such that depends on more data, such that you can get this insertion by differentiating? Introduce a generating functional of the correlation function of this guy. So
just a moment, is that just a gluino or
yes, that's a gluino.
Okay,
so what's the way to proceed is to generalize the object. So we have scattering amplitudes, which depends on x and theta. They depend on a chiral superspace. And what I'm proposing is to consider a bigger object. It depends on new variables, such that now this new variable gives us access to this Goldstone fermion when you differentiate with respect to it. And on the Wilson loop side, this object is actually fairly natural. But people have been, like, if you're doing Wilson loop in superspace, since the 70s, people say N equals 1 Suzy, people have been talking about supersymmetric Wilson loop, and all these Wilson loops were defined on this whole superspace. So this object could be just dual to a Wilson loop on the full superspace. So this is all I'm proposing. I'm proposing, instead of considering Wilson loop in the chiral superspace, consider Wilson loop on the full superspace. And there's some, so people look at this superconnection a lot in the 70s. I think there's some relevant work by Witten in 86 that I mentioned the other day, where he really, I don't know if he was the first, but he discussed the correct constraint equation you have to put on this object to do it in n equals 4. And then Arnad and Schitzer proved that the object actually exists in the classical level.
So those constraint equations imply n equals 4 integrations?
Yes.
Good.
So there's a one-to-one map between solutions of the super Young-Mills equation and the fields for which you can define the super connection. Schnitzer, I think it's Schneider, sorry. I'm getting this. So we're going to consider this object. So this was my attempt at motivating the conjecture. Now we can forget about this. I'm just going to formulate a precise conjecture. Conjecture is that there exists a generalization of, I'm going to propose it for the remainder function and for the ratio function. Let me call it the generalization. We call it the supersymmetrization. More precise. Symmetrization of the remainder function, which is, for those who are not familiar with it, it's an object that is defined from the work of BDS. You take the MHV, let me just put MHV so that it's easier to see what it is. You take the MHV amplitude at any loop level, and there's some universal thing which you can subtract, which accounts for all collinear divergences. And as all correct collinear singularities in our limit. And this remainder function is a finite dual conformal invariant and scheme independent function. So it's a well defined property of the theory. And I'm also going to propose it for the ratio function, which is another well defined. The ratio function is you take different ellipticities. So you take, say, NMHV divided by NHV. So these are finite, scheme-independent, regulator-independent quantities. I'm going to propose that these quantities can be supersymmetrized such that now so Q acting on it, which Q is used, I'm going to write as sum over all particles or d theta I R equal 0, and the other anomaly, the other side, Q bar R, which is sum of particle of delta I dxi, the other guy in the SUSY. I'm going to propose that you can add a d over d theta bar here, such that the right hand side is 0. In other words, I'm proposing that there's actually no anomaly once you include this guy. So now we're turning a complicated problem about the right-hand side into a problem about a completely symmetric object. So that's the conjecture that I want to make. Let me say.
Why don't you have another piece about the first one?
Yeah, you can try many representations. This one is the most useful one in practice. So I choose this one in the definition of the conjecture.
But does this one generate your whole superconformal group that you can write?
Yeah, and then. So again, the second one, yeah, that's good. This should hold for all of them. All the super DCI ones. Yeah, I'm going to write it there. Yeah. Okay. Let me ask two things. There's two things you can ask about conjecture. Conjecture should be useful and ideally it should also be true.
But the first one is more important.
The first one is much more important. I emphasize the order. I emphasize the order. And yes. And that's so in the rest of this talk, I'm not going to spend any time trying to convince you that it's true. So I could try to convince you by it's true, for instance, by showing to you that it works at one loop. But we know the one loop answer, and right now, what we need in this field is not yet another way of looking at one loop. So I'm going to spend the rest of this talk convincing you that it's useful. but you can use it to calculate new quantities. Because in the, yeah, so in this previous anomaly story, there was a sort of a universal roadblock at two loops that it was not clear in any formulation of the proceed. And I think this way you can go. You can go around this roadblock. So it should be true too. It has more, I try to motivate it, but it has moral reason to be true. So that's a conjecture. And I also want to say one thing. I emphasize that formulated the conjecture's statement about an object. And the object should be related to morally to be probably some this recursion loop. Could probably discuss it using correlation function as done by Sakachev and all. There's got to be a way of introducing the theta bar on the scattering amplitude side. There's got to be sort of a CFT way of approaching this object. I don't care. You can compute it the way you want. I care about the object and whether it has the property, whether it exists. So try to use any definition you want. What is important is, does this object exist or not? So that this is what the conjecture is about. In this talk, I'm going to follow this approach for computing it. But I'm not making a conjecture about Wilson loop. I'm making a conjecture about an object. Yes?
I think it's actually natural that you have the Q and Q bar to be asymmetrical at this rate, because this R function is really defined non-chiral. Because it's divided by the image V. So even though you extend it to the theta and theta bar space, but it has to come in a non-chiral way, it knows that it is defined non-chiral.
Sorry, it looks like it's defined chiral, isn't it?
Well,
non-chiral would mean
Q bar and Q is symmetric. You have the theta bar and the x on the Q.
It's convenient, it's convenient in practice, right, in your language. We're making this expansion around MHV, so around self-dual. So it makes a lot of sense to make.
I'm happy with that.
Yeah, we're expanding everything about in steps starting from MHV. So this is natural. This is a natural representation for if you're going to do that. So, that's the statement of the conjecture. Now let's see what this conjecture tells you at two loops. Let's just assume it's true. And so that you quickly get prediction if you believe in it. So the sort of prediction you get is first of all, why is this useful at all? So why do you care about this Q bar? Why the hell do you care? And let's see what's the content of this equation. And the best way to see what this content is to write it in terms of unconstrained variable. We know they exist. They are the momentum twisters introduced by Andrew. They are very useful. So let's see what this equation looks like in terms of unconstrained variable. So this Q is an element of the SU4/4. So in terms of this variable, let me just say what the variables are. There are these. You can make it it's really SU2, 2, 2. Let me write it SU4/4. SU4/4 fundamental, let's call it like this. Can you read?
It's not
one. It's a fundamental that looks like, so you put this twister here, and you put this spinner is here. This is SU4R symmetry, and this is the SU4 conformal group. And these are related to original data in terms of Z, lambda alpha, and lambda x chi alpha dot. And lambda are the usual xi minus x minus lambda alpha bar, the usual spinoricity variable. So these are the variables. And yeah. Okay, so let me just say what the equation looks like in this variable. So this equation is just something like, this has to map some rotation, so it's got to look like something like, the only thing with the right indices is zi e eta I on r for 0. And the other equation, this guy similarly has to map simply to something like sum over i's of eta I zi. And then this guy, we have to come up with something. It's got to look like the parity conjugate of this. So parity conjugate is, parity conjugate of a twister is something with a lower index, which is a plane. So so the only natural plane in this problem is this. We have the spinner index here. We can match the indices, and then this is not eta, so this is chi. And can use some chi bar. And the little group weights of chi bar are such that this equation makes sense. So it's got to be an equation like that. And if you stare at it, it doesn't quite close. So there's got to be some fermion modification you add to it. I mean that. Plus order chi bar. So it's clear that the algebra exists and makes sense. It's just a matter of working it out in these variables. But in this paper, I'm going to work to linear order. This talk is just going to be in linear order, and that's going to be enough. So now, why is this equation useful? If you look at the remainder function, normally it doesn't depend at all on theta. So it's just some bosonic thing. Normally, the remainder function. So if you look at this equation equals 0, take the equation star. If you take d over d chi I of q bar rn equals 0, what you get basically, you remove a chi bar and you're focusing on single derivative like that. So you obtain the following equation. D over dz j a of the remainder function is equal to sum over I, this piece here, minus sum over I, this piece, which is I minus 1, I plus 1, a. And then there's d over d chi bar I, d over d chi j of the remainder function. And if I put this at chi bar equals 0, this at chi bar 0, you basically see that you're computing every single derivative of the function by extracting specific components of this right-hand side. So this formula should be read off as a formula for the derivative, at least at MHV level. This is a formula for the derivative of the answer, the differential of the answer. Because these are the independent variables. You have every derivative.
R depends on what exactly?
So now R is a function of z chi chi bar.
So why is the first equation true? Also, we're assuming that the...
Yeah, so I'm assuming the conjecture, and then this follows. I no longer need. So let's go a little bit further. Okay, what this equation looks... Okay, let's put this equation into a useful form. So let the terms of order chi 1, chi bar 1, in the remainder function be... Let's expand this guy over something like that. So you can... And then you can divide something to have the correct little loop weight. So this sum only makes sense when I and j are not adjacent.
What's on the denominator?
I minus 1, I plus 1, j. Plus adjacent stuff. Yeah, so here, yeah, so I'm summing over all terms for which this makes sense. So I'm defining, I'm just looking at the, I'm just taking the chi-chi bar extension and defining Cij from this equation. Now, what do we learn? If we apply this other symmetry here, from the fact that Qn is zero, this is supposed to be true for, yeah, okay, so now, yeah. Yeah, I didn't say it, but this equation are supposed to be true for the whole superconformal group. So there's the S's are hidden in that. So there's a, this is 16 equation. And this is 16 equation. So now, this is supposed to be true for any SU4 index. Let's fix, say, fix I equal to 2. So I'm putting a chi bar at position 2. And then use 1, 2, 3, Q, R equals 0. This 1, 2, 3, Q, the point of having 1, 2, 3 is that this kills all of the adjacent stuff. From this equation, you learn that sum over J of Cij equals 0. So there's a sum rule like that. And of course, everything, the whole computation of this guy is parity symmetric, so there's going to be some rule like that at its J. Okay, so these guys have to obey the sum rules. And so this is point one. Point two is that all the adjacent stuff is determined from this Cij. So if you apply, for instance, 1, 2, *Q, use this symmetry, for instance, you will get a term that involves the d over dl d chi 3, and that you can relate this to the other one. So the Cijs at non-adjacent location determine everything. And once you do the Cijs determine everything, then it's a matter of a short algebra to express this equation in terms of Cij. And after you do that, that's point three, you get an expression for each derivative in terms of the Cij. And the expression looks like the total differential of the remainder function is equal to sum over I j Cij, so the total differential acting on log minus 1 I plus 1. This was fairly abstract, but now we have a prediction. What is the prediction? If you recall, well, this prediction makes contact with the symbol. So the symbol was defined recursively by equation like that. So this is telling you that the last entry of the symbol to any loop order has to be of this form. Nothing more complicated than that can show up in the last entry of the symbol. So it's a non-trivial prediction. About the last entry of the symbol. So now this was very abstract. Let me become more concrete and tell you how you compute the CIGs, and how you can test whether this prediction makes sense. But you can also ask, what does it, is it true for 6.2 loop? It's true. This is the one data point we add, and it's true. It works. So how do we calculate the CIGs? So this equation now I can erase. This equation is true. This equation also, so that's the statement of the vector, you keep it. So how do you calculate the CIJs? So, well, in principle, you can use the formulation you want. So I'm going to describe how you compute it with the Wilson loop. So imagine some Wilson loop, and let's calculate, say, C2i, rather than Cij. What is C2i? It's something in which, as what it should be morally, is something in which you insert this Goldstone fermion here and here. So the here, there is a science of it here, and there's some sidebar inserted here. So you have to compute a Wilson loop in which you have a psi insertion here and a psi insertion here integrated over this edge. So this insertion is integral dx of, let me write, if there's a parameter of tau, if there's a parameter of t that goes from 0 to 1 along this edge, this operator is psi alpha lambda alpha, where the lambda is the lambda on this thing. And here you have the same complex conjugate equation. You have to calculate this correlation function. And if we're talking about the two-loop remainder function, the Feynman graph that you have look like this fermion and gauge boson like that, and things like that. These are the two Feynman graphs you have to calculate to get this CIJ. Well, there's also the third guy where you got this. And there's the guy here, and permutations. So, many people have struggled, and many people in this room have struggled with the R diagram. And I hope that this can fill you with joy, because if you look at this diagram, then you immediately see that it's more friendly than this one. There's a fermion, there's much less gauge stuff floating around. So I'm hoping this makes you happy. So it's a computation you can try to do. And
your second diagram, the
glue on is just
between any two legs.
So yeah. It's plane over. Yeah. Yeah. And, well, the big point is that as far as the glue sector is concerned, it's basically an abelian computation. So you have this, so that's how you calculate CIJ on this graph. And let me also discuss something. If you really are going to take seriously the super Wilson loop, the super Wilson loop will have terms in which the chi and the chi bars are not adjacent. And there will be something like, I don't know, when there will be a term where there's like chi2, chi bar 2, and some f inserted here. And you would have graphs like that to calculate, and you would be back to the R diagram. So in the sense, this is being clever. This is, the R diagram has not disappeared. But the fact is, thanks to this fact that the CIJs determine everything, the R diagram is related to these ones by Suzy. So you calculate these ones. You could, in principle, if you really wanted, you could calculate this one. But the algebra tells you that it has to be related to this one for your sums over these ones. So if you can avoid computing it, don't.
This should be a particular derivative of the diagram because you have degree 3 here for these functions of degree 3.
Yes, but it's an f, and the fact that it's an f instead of an a reduces the transcendentality by 1.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, it's still simpler than the R diagram because it has the answer has lower transcendentality. But it's still more of a bad guy than this. If you can just compute this, why would you want to calculate this one?
Maybe I can make another comment. Yeah. So this hexagon integral was mentioned before. Yeah. I think computed. It's also a degree 3 function. So actually this hexagon integral has a Wilson line representation, which is in fact almost identical to this picture you drew there.
Yes.
It would be interesting to see if it's actually the same or if it's similar.
Yeah, I've looked at the symbol to see if there was something possible. It's not so clear. Yeah.
Just to make the other comment, so the reason we were interested in this hexagon integral is that in fact it's related by our first derivative,
yes,
two amplitudes which appear in the two Lebesgue amplitudes.
Yes.
Two integrals which appear in the two Lebesgue amplitudes.
Yes.
So this is actually very.
Yes. No, I completely agree. So this is just a fancy way of packaging the differential equations you're working on. We've been working with. So it's a fancy way of packaging them, which is granted to you. So your approach will work in principle for any Feynman diagram. This is the packaging which tells you you're not just computing Feynman diagrams in the random theory. You're computing Feynman diagrams in n equals 4. And that allows them to be packaged.
So what I want to say is this is your conjecture, if you wish, is supported by our differential equations,
yes,
because we find exactly
the same structure.
Equations which are of this type.
Yes, there's exactly the structure. That's correct. Structure is right. So forget about this guy, and you just calculate this guy. Now, yeah. Good if someone could take care of plugging the laptop to the projector. I don't know if anyone in the audience. Well, I can plug it. I can plug it, but the real question is it going to work? So I'm going to continue during this time. It's probably not switching, but I mean, I'm not there yet. So where's going to be my last few minutes? So we can so you will not be surprised to find out, okay, it's possible to do this integral. And if you really want me to explain, I'll tell you techniques I've used. But many people in the audience, if I tell them, okay, you have to calculate this diagram, they'll find their own ways of doing it. And they should get an answer. The question is, so we have an answer that d, the minor function, is some of the Cij of d log I bar. Shortened for I minus 1 I. You have an equation like this. You know what, you can compute them. Is this equation the correct differential of the answer? You want to answer this question without having to do our integrals. And here the symbol has proved very useful because the philosophy is that you can break up the computation in many steps. Ultimately, we're interested in the final answer, but you can break it up. In the past, last fall, we had, well, even before, we always have we have the integrand, which is some well-defined piece of data of the theory that you can calculate as a step towards the answer. And now there's a symbol. And ultimately, there's the answer. And well, hopefully, there's not many steps yet. Hopefully, there's no dot, dot, dot there. But the good thing is, symbol is a well-defined piece of data about the theory, and you can check conjectures on it. And it's simpler to check conjectures on the symbol than checking conjectures on the answer. So, check conjectures at the level of the symbol. So, I haven't actually computed this integral, I've computed this symbol. And so this equation is the same as saying that the symbol of the Riemann function. This equation implies that symbol of the Riemann function is symbol of the CIJ tensor, tensor I bar J. This equation is the same as this equation. So you can ask, okay, are there consistency conditions? Okay, what can you ask about this CIJ? What properties of this do the CIJ have to occur, have to obey? One property is conformal invariance. So this should somehow organize into cross ratios. And this is manifest in the formalism. It comes out from the sum rule that I had before. The sum rule is equivalent to conformal invariance. So it's conformal you get a conformal invariant symbol. So the second constraint that you have, you can write equations like that as long as you want, but the total differential has better be closed. Otherwise, that equation doesn't make any sense. And this is what people call the integrability of the symbol. If you had the function, if I had the CIJs as function, I could check this as functions. If I only have the CIJs as symbol, and I can check this on the level of symbols.
The CIJs are not conforming there on their own.
Each CIJ is conformal invariant, but the last entry also has to be conformal invariant.
So and your diagram, this diagram you drew over there.
Yes.
Or
yes.
Only the CIJs, or just the CIJs are mapped 1-to-1 to the diagram. Right? So is that diagram conforming invariant?
Yes. The sum overall. Yeah. After you sum over the blue rounds, it's conformal invariant. Yes.
Oh, you have to sum.
Yes. Yes.
Only if you sum.
Yes. Yes, but then each CIJ for each I and J is conformal invariant. But then the fact that this equation defines a conformal invariant function requires this sum rule. So this is the sort of thing you can ask. And basically, after you've done this check, there's really this equation, as I'm going to try to emphasize, is this equation really restricts incredibly the structure of the CIJs. Not many transcendental functions can obey this sort of identity. They have to somehow telescopically cancel. This seems to be really a key to the structure of the answer. And once I managed to have an answer that obeyed that, it was basically impossible to see how to modify it. And then there's a stressful moment when you hit Shift Enter and ask whether this is true, and it worked directly. So and then the third question you can ask is, does it have correct Kolmogorov limits? So let me remind you that if you have this hexagon, if you have if you take an heptagon, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and make two corners become make two edges become null and parallel to each other. So you're reducing one particle. The defining property of the remainder function is that R7 should go to R6 in this limit, which is actually a very, very strong requirement, because as you take this limit, you're using 3 degrees of freedom, and limit has to be independent of how you approach it. Yeah, you need to have 3 variables which decouple at that limit. So I think I can take that. This is just so that you can stare at the symbol and see what sort of function it looks like. So yeah, this is the full. This is the answer that you get. So there's the structurally 4 sort of things. So there's terms, so the C1, which basically accounts for the terms which dominates in the limit of a large number of legs. So now this is for the log of the amplitude, so you get diagrams that are not, get all diagrams that look non-planar. And C1s account for all this sort of boring factorized stuff. So C1 is the leading term in the large number of particle limits. And then C2 is the real bad guy, which involves these things. And actually, this is not gauge invariant. There's a certain trick that I used, which was to complete this box here and somehow couple this. Instead of just computing this graph, sort of computed a certain box here and this dashed line. I can explain what it means. So there's sort of a way to close it in the gauge invariant way to get. But as everyone knows in this business, if you don't compute gauge invariant quantities, life is hard. But usually things get better if you compute gauge invariant sort of pieces. So there was a way of making this gauge invariant. And C3 is the other guy. And C4 is some sort of reminder that involves just the 4, that involves just everything. So this is I and J, it involves just those 4 points. So C4 is just a function of the single cross ratio of those 4 points. So it sort of has this structure. So this is the guy, the only guy for which you have to suffer, and it's this integral. So okay, it looks like a bit of garbage, and actually I have not defined what I5 is. But it's basically all it is. That's the all n symbol. So once you have this expression, under arithmetic and Mathematica, you can check these limits. So 7 goes to 6 works out, and I actually check 10 goes to 9. And you can also check the other piece of data we have in the literature, which is special kinematics. And at the level of this symbol, I've checked that you correctly get the 2D kinematic octagon. So you take this whole beast and you reduce it to 2D kinematics, you get some simple, very, very simple thing with 4 logs. So each C actually becomes 3 logs. So this answer, which was derived assuming this conjecture, ends up passing all these consistency checks. And well, that convinces me is the right symbol. The next ultimate check would be to integrate the symbol and check the numbers. But at this stage, we can say that everything seems to work out. So let me tell you a little more about this structure. So as I said, there's some rules are, so maybe I go on for 5 minutes. I know how much longer.
That's fine.
So this sum rule is really key to this structure. So how does it work? Well, first of all, what is this i5? i5 is a one loop pentagon. So you're computing. So this triangle involves 6 points. So it's something that a graph. It's roughly this graph, but sort of more gauge invariant than gauge invariant way of looking at it. So basically this, and you see 6 points, and this i5 is basically the pentagon that you make out of 5 of them at a time. So you see a bunch of i5s that here, and there's just the pentagon integral. And for those of you who are familiar with these integrals, the thing that looks like 5 dialogues and 1 log. It's the same analytic expression as a 2 massive box. 5 dialogues and 1 log. So it's this function here. So somehow the logs want to organize into these combinations, which is also very reminiscent of the differential operator story.
But this integral appears on the inhomogeneous term, yeah. So that explains why it's in the first term.
Yeah. I tried to organize everything in terms of these i5s, and it didn't work out. There was an obstruction. That's too bad.
Well, we can discuss a little later.
Yeah. So the way things work, as I said, things have to cancel telescopically. The way this works is that if you take this particular i5 that involves these points, say this first line, actually, which was this i5. It gets here, and then you get minus the other i5 with this point exchange in such a way that And the prefactor is obtained by changing I and I plus 1, which means that when you're going to sum over this I, which is what the sum will ask you to do, you get a telescopic sum. So the first line cancels telescopically in the sum rule. And then there's another cancellation pattern, which is not so clear, is that you have other sort of i5s. The i5s that involve this guy. This guy. And the way they cancel is that they are anti-symmetric in those two. So this, if it is odd under those two. So there are basically two cancellation patterns. And that tells you a lot about the structure of what the answer looks like. And so let me stop and ask the let me stop with a list of probably the next directions. Well, first of all, we have to integrate this symbol, or at least find some integral representation in which we can see all these properties. So I've mentioned all these properties that I've checked. I can check them at the level of the symbol. I cannot check them at the level of the integral representation that I have right now. So integrate, or find some nice integral representation And it's very likely, if you manage to have an integral representation that makes manifest all these properties, may I try to guess it. You would think that if you manage to have a guess, it's unique. So, or maybe guess some integral representation. So yeah, you have many, many symmetries. You can try guesswork. And maybe that's going to be a useful way to go. So you have the symbol, and you come up with an integral representation, compute it, you come up with an ansatz, you can check whether it gives you the same answer. There's some data. And the second thing is we have to go to higher orders in chi bar. In all of this story, I've just used supersymmetry once. I've taken one derivative with respect to chi bar, and I have learned all the structure. And if one understands the algebra at higher orders, and there's going to be a whole lot of constraints that come out of that. And one can try to make wild speculation, because at some point there's only a finite number of chi bars. You're 6 points. You only have 8 chi's and 8 chi bars. What happens when you fill out of when they're all filled up? Something's got to happen. I don't know what, but we have to understand the algebra completely here. And so 6 particles, 4 each, minus the number of symmetry. Okay. So this is like MHV bar, if you wish. So the algebra has to be understood, and there's gonna be juice here. So that's an open direction. And I want to say a third thing. But of course, you want to go to higher loops than you want to do all sort of things. what did I want it to say? I leave it at that. Thank you.
Any questions for Simon?
It's thought up in Russell's work, the answer in a very similar form. When you think about it, it's generating some flow, which generates translation in respect of time. Can you see something?
Sorry, which form are you referring to?
The differential of the answer.
Yes, at strong cutting, weak cutting?
Yeah, it's all
at strong cutting, yes.
When you think about it, as something that generates flow in the
the parameter.
Can you give some such interpretation
if we can start
to see what it means?
You mean, could this be a connection to the spectral parameter? That they use the spectral parameter. Maybe, I don't know.
Anything else? Thanks a lot, Simon.